Hello and welcome back to the final lecture in this is the American prison state. My name is D'Amico. Lecture is an attempt to give some public policy recommendations informed by the traditions of constitutional political economy that we've been surveying throughout the course, mainly Austrian economics, constitutional political economy, public choice theory, and new institutional economics. It's not to say necessarily that these traditions are so easily described in their policy suggestions as saying laissez-faire, hands-off, let markets decide. In particular, the reason why we need a more refined public policy discussion on criminal justice is in large part because the conditions that we exist within are not from the position of a blank slate. So, in other words, many people get caught up in the comparative institutional analysis of, say, market-run services compared to governmental-run services. And both of those hypothetical constructs exist in a form of historical, cultural, and contextual vacuums. Whereas what we're looking for more is a way in which to promote effective policy transition from our current system. And a large reason for that, I would say, is because of the state of this instability or unsustainability regarding the practices of our criminal justice system. In many ways, and for several years, a variety of scholars have been referring to the trend of mass incarceration and the expenditures associated with mass incarceration in the United States as a prison crisis. Now, in large part, crises create forms of opportunity for policy change. In that sense, there is both opportunity for improvement and or opportunity for, say, more forms of expansion in the types of inefficiencies that we practice now. So the motivation that I had when I was putting together some of this material was like, well, in the transition case of, say, the Soviet Union, or in any form of transition studies, and we're going to talk a little bit about precisely what we mean by transition economics as opposed to comparative institutional economics, but in any of these cases, when you, after, say, the Soviet Union enjoyed the Washington Consensus, after the intellectual debate between, say, capitalism and socialism had been won on the side of capitalism, we got a sort of different intellectual project from applied political economy, mainly where we had once been fascinated in and interested in comparing how those different institutional arrangements, socialism versus market liberalism, were doing things like coordinating capital resources or resolving pricing dilemmas. Instead, we got more focused explicitly on asking, well, how is it that we allow for the generation of the types of institutions that are critical to market transactions? The Washington Consensus was in and of itself an agreement or a consensus amongst economic professionals that markets were the preferable way of coordinating society. And it was a matter of asking, well, how do we move from here to there? So here on to sort of motivate the application of that intellectual exercise in the criminal justice system is this very telling and revealing quote from Randy Barnett, in the preface to Bruce Benson's 1998 book, To Serve and Protect. The United States today delivers law and order in the same socialist manner that the USSR delivered food and shoes, and with comparable results. So again, this form of crisis is driven predominantly by the corrections industry, with the largest percentage growth in expenditures in all of the constituent forms of the criminal justice system, and in large part because of its exponential increase in sheer size and magnitude regarding the population of prisoners in the United States, as we can see. And again, we should remember from previous lectures that this doesn't necessarily correlate with a proportionate decline in violent crime. Yes, the 1990s have seen significant declines in crime rates, but so have a variety of other countries without this exponential increase, and so have a variety of American periods without this exponential increase. So one way to think about what exactly if we accept the fact that there is something of a criminal justice crisis in the United States, that some form of institutional change is going to have to occur, again, remember Bob Higgs has this very telling quote that if incarceration rates are to continue to increase at the rate at which they currently are, then by the year 2080 there will be more people incarcerated in the United States than there would be in its free citizen population. And that we would then have to update our immigration policy in order to have people to staff and manage those prison facilities. I think that that is telling, and it's very unsustainable moving forward. And so some form of policy change is going to take place. The way in which I like to conceptualize this for my students is, like, think about a no-holds-barred match or, like, some sort of, like, intellectual debate between, say, Bob Higgs on the one hand, crisis and Leviathan, each potential policy crisis creates an opportunity for government to expand and perhaps grow the rate of its expansion beyond that which it was growing before. So we can imagine a sense in which the resources of criminal justice are totally out of whack with regard to actual efficient responses in terms of civil society, informal social bonds. A lot of people are sort of drawing this commentary out of the London riots, for example, arguing that the welfare systems have not only grown a sense of entitlement, which is then thrown into disarray when it's sort of retracted, but it's also crowded out historically would have been very trust-enhancing and community-developing forms of civil association and social order. Mainly when individuals within communities don't have the state to utilize and depend upon for things like social safety nets or welfare benefits, et cetera, they have to think creatively and coordinate with one another. And those bonds and interactions actually host other forms of cultural tolerance, et cetera. So if we can imagine that this sort of crisis has the potential to be exploited as a form of state expansion, wherein these resources are out of whack, there's going to be institutional tensions, and as a consequence, we could expect social order to degrade. Now, in that sort of environment, there's an opportunity to shape the narrative and argue in favor of expansionary spending. I mean, if the only tool that you have to solve a problem is a hammer, all the world looks a nail. And in so far as we've seen militarization as a strategy in foreign entitlements and arguably as a strategy of responding to social problems domestically in the criminal justice system, it seems that that is the sort of natural go-to, that sort of iconic events, whether they be like school shootings or the race riots and urban upheaval, crime trends, gang violences, all of these things in both the media and the political realm are used as catalysts to grow state expansion. So the Higgs perspective is sort of one possible route that we could be going down in terms of this form of crisis. And on the other side, we should we almost think in terms of the admission of transition economists a la Milton Friedman, which caused such animosity from scholars like Naomi Klein, that it is a real opportunity for institutional change. And if there is theoretical perspective akin to something like a Washington consensus in this public policy sphere, then these forms of crisis often create what, say, James Buchanan would call a constitutional moment, an opportunity in which perhaps you can redesign the institutional structure of decision-making behind these trends so as to constrain the state moving forward. So I sort of think of this as Naomi Klein versus Bob Higgs as to who will win out in this form of crisis. So if we don't have some form of transition analysis, some form of, say, vision of how to, provide forms of criminal justice services without succumbing to the challenges of state inefficiencies and bureaucratic growth that we've been concerned about over the course of the semester, we need a vision as to how that can work and how that can function and what scope of institutions stand as our available alternatives. I really love, there's this great quote in Ronald Coase's Lighthouse article that says that, like, those forms of research, historical examples of private provisions of public goods, give us a creative vision as to the scope of alternatives and institutional forms that we can hope to use to apply to our own forms of social problems today. So we need a vision as to how functional spontaneous order, free market, private civil society can be on the one hand. And then we also need a full vision as to practical ways in which state bureaucratic inefficiencies can be constrained. What system of checks and balances would be required in order to keep, if the current system led to the forms of crisis that we're enduring today, what forms of constraint would be required to keep the system from generating those forms of crisis again in the future? So this is sort of what's motivating this line of inquiry. First and foremost, I think it's interesting to understand the intellectual history behind the Austrian tradition within what we could call comparative institutional analysis within economic science, and then secondly, a subgroup or related disciplines within economics, both transition economics and development economics. So comparative institutional analysis is basically the socialist calculation debate. To a large extent, we, just as the socialists used to joke that we owed, or they owed Mises a favor in demonstrating the calculational problem that they thought that they had solved by means of sort of like computer modeling. And then there was a joke even at one point where they were saying, well, we should build a statue to Mises in the hall of like the Soviet Hall of Fame, so to speak. In much the same way, economists should really be thankful for the experience of the Soviet Union for teaching us a lot about price theory. So the structure of the intellectual endeavor that was comparative institutional analysis during the highlight of the Soviet Union was pretty straightforward. It was, there were these two radically different, differently organized societies. The Soviet Union, in which the capital resources were centrally controlled and managed by a government authority. And then in contrast, we had the West, which was predominantly governed in with regard to production and distribution decisions by individual private property owners of capital. And so if you ask questions about general resource production, GDP, pricing, interest rates, all of these things, if you said, okay, well, how is it that borrowing and lending operate in the Soviet Union, and then you can compare it to borrowing and lending as it operates in the market, price theory, et cetera. Well, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there's not much to compare to anymore, and the body of real historical empirical evidence sort of coming down the pipeline day in and day out is evidence that the institutional framework was unfeasible from the bottom up, and so the scholars who were largely dedicated to the comparative project changed gears in large part. It wasn't any longer sort of listing merits and consequences of each individual system and then comparing them against one another, but it was instead a much more practical research program in which the question was not necessarily, okay, well, which system is better or likely to lead towards greater economic performance, but instead a recognition that economic performance, sustainable economic performance at all, requires a foundation of market economies. And so then the question becomes, well, what forms of institutions lay prerequisite for those market processes to take hold and develop? And secondly, how can those institutions be accommodated for and allowed for and grown to develop? So development economics and transition economics become sort of bedfellows in much the same way as we're concerned how a market economy might be grown where none has existed at all. We are also concerned about how we might grow a market economy in, say, like the wreckage and rubble of a declined economic system. But those are very different questions. In other words, the challenges and the heartaches that you might be dealing with in a transition case could be significantly different from a development case, developmental case. On this, we can think of, say, during the Soviet Union, the majority or a significant majority of a significant amount of goods and services were produced and distributed by means of black markets. Now, upon the eve of the collapse of the Soviet Union, those black markets don't necessarily disappear, in large part because they have there are cultural, human, social networks that are in conjunction with those ways of producing and distributing goods and services. So those things don't just disappear overnight by legislative fiat in much the same way as in, say, natural disaster environments, they don't disappear. It really is the sort of social bonds and networked connections of the subjective humane element that needs to be understood and recognized there. So whenever those processes are at play, you run the risk of failing to account for those complex, subtle, and tacit learning processes that would be required to fully plan and or step into that that informal context. In large part, the transitioning nations of the former Soviet Union today are still sort of feeling some of the consequences of the long legacy of socialism. Whereas in a development context, you could argue that it would be more akin to, say, finding profit opportunities and establishing certain forms of like monetary systems and property rights regimes, as opposed to making sure that you're not implementing or designing institutions which explicitly conflict with the forms of social arrangements at play in the black market. Two examples to sort of get at the heart of what I'm trying to articulate here. The first would be, again, in the Soviet Union, it was often argued that what we needed was a system of property rights that could articulate and formalize and codify that which dogs in people's backyards already sort of knew, right? The legislative system on the books said that all of the capital ownership, all of the land, all of the property was held collectively by the people, so to speak. Well, now we sort of burn those legislative documents. We collapse the formal authority regime that gives that vision of property ownership its authority. And now what we need is, again, a codification system, because you want that quantitative tractability. You want to be able to exchange and trade your goods and services in a formal, recognized, transparent regime. But you don't have that recourse of the formal legislative process that, that used to be in place. And so anyone that you then put in place runs the risk of conflicting with the norms and traditions that are endogenized in, say, the dog's behavior for barking at people who don't belong in his backyard, and or the informal processes of trade exchange that were taking place in the black market, and oftentimes with slightly unsavory or very unsavory practices and institutional patterns, because, again, those black market reactions to excessive prohibition have a particular effect on the capital structure. It has a particular effect on the physical capital structure. Drugs become more potent and less convenient for consumer use when they're prohibited, because you're trying to sort of transport them in the most convenient stealth way that you can. But then we should expect the cultural networks and the social networks to also be affected by that prohibition, that you're going to have a value of secrecy and a degree of more violent enforcement as you don't have recourse to traditional legal and conflict resolution. Again, that the sort of silver lining on that is the fact resorting to violence in that context has a natural constraint. It's not necessarily completely chaotic, let's say. So that's one example, this sort of, even the dogs recognize the informal economic reality of property ownership, even though the like formal books in the Soviet Union don't recognize it. Another example would be DeSoto's work on the mystery of capital, not Huerta de Soto, Jesus Hernando de Soto. I think that he's a bit more guilty of Bloch's interpretation of Coase than is Coase. In other words, in The Mystery of Capital, one gets the impression that any property right delineage will lead to some degree of development for an underdeveloped context. So you look at a third world environment that doesn't have property rights, and then De Soto, inspired by Coase, is saying, okay, let's just give receipts for all of the capital goods in this economy, and then if they're imperfect, who cares? Coase theorem will hold, because people will just trade until the resources for their most highly valued use. I think at face value, there is something to that if the pure inefficiency is driven by a lack of formalized, codified, articulated property rights, then you would expect efficiency gains. But what De Soto, I think, fails to recognize is that the challenge lineating the in a matching pattern of how people already reflect them or recognize them is it grows all the more complicated the less property rights are already formalized in that environment. So the more unarticulated they are, the more likely it is that your formal top-down legislative process is going to screw them up. So on that, I really like Claudia Williams' work on informal institutions rule. We mentioned that last week. So again, the challenge of institutional development is unique for a transition scenario than it is for a development context. So when we're talking about transitioning, so to a large extent, here's the sort of project of a transition analysis or transition public policy for criminal justice. Let's just imagine for a second that we are in crisis. Let's presume that that's accurate. Let's imagine that we do need some form of institutional reform. What sorts of policy recommendations would we come about with if we had something like a policy consensus akin to the Washington consensus on the realm of criminal justice? Let's imagine that everyone in the criminal justice sphere suddenly wakes up, as did political economists circa the collapse of the Soviet Union, that market processes are preferable to establishing and promoting social order without violent crime relative to governmental processes. What forms of policy suggestions would likely work, and how could they be implemented to help transition from a state-based criminal justice provision to a more voluntary method. So to give sort of teeth as to what we would be talking about, here are just a few. I think that, again, one of the biggest sort of challenges faced by our current criminal justice system is that it obviously generates a significant amount of vested interests in the status quo state provision of law and law enforcement. Democracy in deficit, Wagner and Buchanan, they explain that with every fiscal injection, the Keynesian program generates a new vested interest that then will stand in opposition to policy reform that takes the shape of cutting or contracting that particular bureaucratic entity. Now, in some transition work, what has been argued in order to overcome this issue is something akin to, like, gifting. In other words, let us imagine producers of shoes in the Soviet Union. There's warehouses, there's production factories, there's distribution channels, et cetera. The iPencil to look at. So every person that chain of comes out of vested interest who may stand as an obstacle to reform. One of the reform in mid-stride or keeping reform from ever taking hold. So in the case of a fat shooter in the Soviet Union, one of the recommendations was, okay, this is sort of like DeSoto, just give it to him, right? Rather than worrying about necessarily who's going to be the major providers in the future, we should admit that current producers probably have a degree of tacit knowledge that current non-producers or unrelated individuals don't have. Secondly, okay, let's say this is like the most corrupt and backward shoe factory in the world. At the very least, he's now confronted with a very real incentive to either sell his now privately owned capital asset or video and audio both lost. Danny, can you check on that? Is anyone else having a problem with video or audio? No. Okay. I'm going to keep going. So David and Danny, you guys should... Okay. So one of two things happens in the event that the factory owner gets sort of gifted his factory. Either he's going to sell out, right? To someone who can harness that capital for a more productive use, or he's going to benchmark efficient practices and get with the program, so to speak. But either way, the capital gets used in a preferable industry. But what's really important is that he's not necessarily inclined to be politically active against reform. How we would go about accomplishing this in the criminal justice setting would require some creative thinking. However, I do think it's slightly less of a concern in the criminal justice setting because so many private individuals do exist who do comparable jobs and have sort of held roles or kept feet in multiple camps. In other words, lots of private security agents are former police officers and vice versa. Lots of private prison contractors are former public prison unionists. But I think it's interesting to note that the last vestige of unions in the United States is the public education system and the police system, despite some news media denying libertarians' willingness to admit that. Lots of people have been saying that from libertarian perspectives for a very long while. But so these are policy suggestions that I think would be needed in order to motivate a more civil society response to criminal justice and a less government-monopolized criminal justice system than what we have today. So we radically cut federal and state criminal justice financing. I mean, in much the same way as we would hope for radical cuts in military spending abroad, to some extent, we would need a constitutional constraint moving forward. Again, this process of spending seems to naturally funnel resources into those arenas that more suit state interest than public interest. So when we looked at the historical growth of incarceration and the historical growth of costs in the criminal justice system, we should also recognize that along that trajectory is a growth in how those resources get used towards criminal policies that do not reflect the aggregate preferences of society, but instead reflect a very explicit private interest of ruling elites to prohibit substances, as well as funnel additional financial resources into bureaucracies. One of the things that I find strange in the drug decriminalization debates today is how people refer to the importance of decriminalizing and then taxing and regulating drug substances. And I think that part of the confusion there that I'm most concerned with is that that is a failure to admit that the current system operates and does create tax revenue. The civil asset forfeiture, as well as the way in which the federal government has allowed for local police constituents to keep the amount of money confiscated from drug dealers and drug agents, has created a direct financial incentive for police to enforce these laws. That before those incentives exist, you had a lot lesser degree of local compliance, right? And you see this cross-nationally today. Most countries have criminalized drugs. Most countries don't allow for the consumption of marijuana, cocaine, opium, etc. However, not every country does what we do in response to it, in particular at the federal level, right? So local cities have local police jurisdictions, and there's a degree of discretion and affordability for them to enforce against those practices. And then they allocate their enforcements to major drug-producing and distributing issues and major violent outbreaks that are tied to that, rather than all-out sort of militarized prohibition response. You didn't see those sort of tactics take place until the federal government took a much more activist role in promoting drug criminality in the late 1980s, as well as offering these forms of financial incentives. But when civil asset forfeiture takes hold, when police jurisdictions are capable of sapping this wealth from the drug trade, that's a tax. That form of wealth goes directly to the government. However, the difference here is that the people, so to speak, the voters, don't get a say in how that tax then gets dispensed. In the traditional political process, we get to vote for candidates who determine spending, and government budgets come from a variety of sources, and so on and so forth. But it is those local police jurisdictions that get to keep those financial resources. And so that tax doesn't go to promoting schools or roads or things that we might say have a greater role in promoting social order and civil society, they instead go directly into the sort of law enforcement wing of government. And so the balance between, say, the police state and the welfare state gets thrown out of whack inevitably by increased spending regimes across the board. Secondly, what you would need is to empower the private security industry. There's dozens, if not hundreds, of sort of bizarre laws that, because of the way public security officials and public law enforcement agents are given unique privileges compared to ordinary citizens or sovereign corporations. So, for example, in a variety of states, and this is exactly what you see in the Athenian case, but sort of writ large today. In, say, New Jersey, it's illegal to have a firearm on you while you're transporting someone who is in bondage. So this is a criminal law that's left over on the books from kidnapping cases and other such violent crime cases. But so what it does is it means that private prison contracting and private security contracting for the distribution and transportation of prisoners is impossible without formal government anointed police officers, so to speak. So you would need an even playing field of regulatory policy between private industry providers as well as public providers. And most of the legislative differences that separate those two things are tied to bondage, duress, and constraint, the question of applying criminal sentences. Say what you will about private prisons as they exist today, they do not have a legitimate authority to discern which laws they will or will not incarcerate for, nor do they have the ability necessarily to think outside the box as to what punitive mechanisms will work best on those cases. You would need that degree of autonomy to get a truly alternative system of criminal punishments to eventually emerge. I don't think that prohibition could possibly be sustainable from a competitive system. And so what I think, for example, lots of people are willing to entertain this hypothesis about ending the war on drugs. Interestingly enough, Peter Moskos has this fascinating book on In Praise of Flogging. And again, he advocates flogging as an alternative to avoid the costs and consequences of incarceration. He's really just being sensationalist in a way to package the social commentary against incarceration, which he does extremely well. But what I don't think he's honest in his assessment of is the fact that we had a system of flogging which sort of inevitably led to a system of incarceration. So there's no real mechanism to keep that from happening in his proposal. There's no link between his theoretical case that, oh, well, we should also decriminalize all these drugs because they're leading the inefficiencies of the incarceral project. Well, decriminalizing drugs would solve most of your problems, then you wouldn't even need to replace incarceration from flogging, so to speak. The question is how you actively get a decriminalization policy. Admittedly, I don't have answers for that. It does seem that decriminalization of certain substances like marijuana is probably going to be generational more than anything else. So, for example, Prop 19 failed to pass by a very small margin in California this year, but over 35% of those midterm election voters were over the age of 65, so which is extremely correlated with sort of antipathy towards drug legalization issues. So I think that it's sort of a waiting game on that particular substance. I really like the sort of radical implications of relying more upon the civil courts in comparison to criminal courts. So one of the major, I think, obstacles to seeing restitution practices emerge, right? It's one thing to argue about paradigms of justice and say, okay, restitution has lots of functionality compared to rehabilitation, but arguably, you can't centrally plan a restitution regime, which is exactly what criminal sentencing grids have tried to do, only it's not restitution-based, it's still retributive-based. But planning for a menu of restitution prices it would be just as problematic as would be the knowledge and incentive problems that are at play right now. So the question is, what repeals would allow for a restitution system to emerge? And I think that one of the interesting things is that for all intents and purposes, the functional proportionality and responsiveness and constraint that we would hope for in the criminal process when we look at alternative criminal justice systems in quasi-anarchistic or stateless societies, all of those functional features do exist in our tort process, in our civil legal system. However, the relationship of legal liability between criminal and civil cases is all screwed up to ever get that form of functionality in our criminal processes. Let me explain. The O.J. Simpson trial is an interesting case. Here you have O.J. Simpson, extremely wealthy at the time, suspected of criminally murdering another individual. Let's propose for a sec that he did it and he's guilty. The criminal liability takes precedent to civil liability, right? So in our real historical past, O.J. Simpson was found not guilty in criminal court, and then after that case, he was held to a civil process and was found liable for significant punitive damages to the Goldmans as a result. Now, in real terms, they've seen almost none of that because, A, it cost him lots of money to run that criminal trial. B, if he had been found guilty, he wouldn't have had the capacity to re-earn and or repay wealth because the criminal charges would take trump. It wouldn't matter how much money you owed or how much of a financial obligation you had to other people if you had first a prison sentence that you were liable to serve to the state. And so that that relationship of the precedence of criminal liability to the state over civil liabilities to individual people, to allow for restitution to functionally evolve would have to be eliminated. In other words, there would be no primary debt owed to state institutions. And John Asnes has a really interesting argument. I've seen him give presentations. He hasn't necessarily written up yet, but his argument is basically that we don't need a criminal law, that proprietary violations and even physical violent provocations can be resolved by civil legal processes. Then that changes the question of who's responsible for financing, like, the on-the-street forms of retaliation. But lots of literature from our development economics as well as social order and political theory allude to the fact that that's really not that big of a challenge of overcoming. Security investments and private capital investments are better at deterring those forms of expropriation than are the formal criminal prohibitions per se. Now, the radicalness of these forms of proposals, extremely cutting police spending, deregulating the security industry, ending prohibitions and drug wars, basically releasing nonviolent offenders from jail, et cetera, these seem like they would have this sort of massive schism or shock on our social world. And arguably, we have a body of research dedicated to understanding how similar processes take place. So, in the context of let's say, socialized economic production. Again, imagine our shoe factory in the Soviet Union. What shock therapy admits to is, or the theories associated with economic shock therapy admits to, is that shoes are good, right? And even though the government is producing them, shoes in and of themselves are good, and people do, in fact, need them. And so in the immediate aftermath of, say, the collapse of the Soviet Union and eliminating state production and state management of things like shoe production, could be short interim periods of time where there is no shoe production, and that's a problem. And so the logic of shock therapy, though, is that, well, in current unsustainable forms, the economy exists on this T1 to Z trend line, right, where over time your economic prosperity GDP is declining because of the incentives and knowledge problems underway from the central decision-making process. So the question becomes, how can we change to trajectory 2, which admittedly involves a short run decline from A to B, but a longer run trajectory where the general economic performance would be as high as Y over Z. And so the hopes of doing transition analysis is that you can predict and or guide policies that will shorten the downfall from A to B, as well as in terms of its significant effect on economic prosperity and social order, but also its effect in time. Like you want your trough to be deep but quick, and less deep if possible. So, in the context of criminal justice services, we should admit that yes, an immediate sort of policy change from a criminalized drug environment to a non-criminalized drug environment, or a publicly administered and funded prison system to a non-retributive model of criminal justice, there would be a lot of growing pains associated with that, probably. But a lot of what we have learned from shock therapy experiences abroad should inform us to be a little bit optimistic about how jarring and shocking that growing pain period would be. In other words, first of all, we have seen this insight that hard budget constraints lead to preferable criminal sentencing outcomes. Michael Tonry in 1990 wrote this sort of comparative case where he surveys all of the various states had applied models of attempted proportionality by means of criminal sentencing grids and criminal sentencing commissions, and it was basically, they had a form of Washington consensus, but instead of a Washington consensus on markets promoting criminal justice better than states or vice versa, they had a Washington consensus that, well, there are too many people in jail and we should lower the amount of people in jail. Well, with that form of consensus, they still couldn't figure out what mechanisms could practically lower prison populations and average criminal sentences. What ended up working was that those states that had budgetary crises and just straight up could not afford to incarcerate any more people actually implemented strategies to that in real terms lowered their prison populations as well as their average criminal sentencing length. Minnesota is like a good example of this, circa mid-1990s. In that sense, we've seen that these forms of fiscal real constraints can induce a degree of preferable resource allocation without massive crime increases. So you arguing that cutting police budgets or cutting cops on the street is going to lead to some form of crime wave and opportunism by organized crime, I don't think necessarily holds. Secondly, violent crime is relatively low right now. So we are in a world where we're devoting a lot more of our commercial environment to, or a lot more of our commercial trades and exchanges to mediums that don't lend themselves to direct forms of violent criminal predation. In other words, with the rise of things like debit cards as opposed to cash transactions, it's a lot more difficult for armed robbery, muggings, etc. Secondly, in a world where more and more of our social interaction is taking place online, it's a lot more difficult to sort of rape, pillage, and plunder from one another. Furthermore, one of the biggest obstacles to effective shock therapy in third world environments is this notion of cultural proximity. In other words, when you're dealing with an environment like the Soviet Union, for example, let's say an entire generation or several generations of people are just acclimated and used to getting food from a voucher system or being doled their occupation by a central authority or bureaucracy. That's a difficult cultural learning process to then explain to these populations, okay, well now you own this and exchange by means of monetary currencies, et cetera. Similarly, if you're trying to develop an economy amongst, say, indigenous tribesmen or something like that, where they literally just have no cultural comprehension of market processes. Well, again, we should be more hopeful for domestic public policy reform, because if that's the major challenge in shock therapy abroad, it shouldn't be as challenging here. I mean, when you're telling people, okay, well, you live in Manhattan and you're not going to be able to rely on the New York Police Department anymore, it's not like they're totally out to lunch on alternatives. Private security markets do exist. And the notion of, well, how you would pay for services at the private or individuated level isn't completely outside the box of the creative potential of entrepreneurship that takes place in a market economy already. Lastly, I think that the insights of shock therapy argue that the downturn is felt most significantly and harshest by the poorest of populations, but actually they're the ones who are most significantly harmed by our failing police institutions as it is, and they're the ones most investing in their informal institutional processes as means of evading from the inefficient predations of our governmental criminal justice system. So the people who would need the informal institutions to rely upon the most are the very people who have them, and the very people who are supposedly standing to suffer the most under a potential shock therapy reform are the people who are suffering the most under our current institutional arrangement. So, I mean, they're also most capable to adapt and be resilient to those changes. In financial terms, I've put together a few numbers. Admittedly, these are pretty back-of-the-envelope calculations. They're 2007 Bureau of Justice Statistics numbers. In the reading list is a much more thorough and sophisticated analysis published most recently by Jeff Miron at the Cato Institute, which basically breaks down every state expenditure on all the different portions of the criminal justice system and tries to demonstrate exactly how much money we're talking about could be saved by means of eliminating the war on drugs. And even if you just cut, like, leave everything else the same of how we criminally sentence, how we provide prisons, how we have publicly subsidized and managed police officers, et cetera, even if we maintain all of that and just cut prohibition, drug prohibition spending, we save massive amounts of money. So this is just showing the number of inmates that's different between, say, including versus excluding drug violations and property crimes in much the same way as we were discussing before, if we could resolve those things without incarceration but instead through the civil court processes or not having them prohibited at all. It's a significant chunk. This is sort of inmate populations broken down by the 20 most prison populated states. Again, Miron's report has all 50 states. When I was just putting this together, some of the smaller prison states, their websites don't have as accessible information, so you have to rely upon the Bureau of Justice Statistics. here are some of the financial differences. I mean, stand to save $9.4 billion, essentially, if this is just calculating per inmate cost expenditures. So again, this would be high estimates of cutting from the incarceral project, but low estimates insofar as it's only the incarceral wing. So you'd have to also talk about how many resources and labor units are deployed at the policing realm and in the judicial process that contribute to the war on drugs. And lastly, the extent to which our violent criminals are driven by incentive arrangements from the war on drugs. So while these are total estimates at all 50 states, which seem like a romantic overestimate to cut all simultaneously, we should recognize that these are probably lowballed estimates of savings insofar as they could induce further efficiencies in other forms of the criminal justice production process. But mostly what I thought was interesting is that if you cut the states into quintiles about who spends the most per inmate seems to be correlated with who has the most inmates. So it's like there's some economies of scale at the lower end. Incarcerating more people means that you get better at it per unit. But those marginal gains quickly diminish as you move to the higher quintiles of incarceration. Second of all, those higher rates of expense and higher rates of population are strongly correlated with higher rates of drug offenders. So the more drug offenders you have in your facility, the more drug offenders you have in your facility, the more offenders you have in your facility on net, and the more you end up paying per offender in your facility. So again, the costs of our system are directly correlated or directly tied to the war on drugs. Now, again, I think that there's reason to be optimistic about how radical policy reforms would not be so devastatingly or shocking in our domestic environment. In other words, like if we significantly cut the budgets of the New York Police Department, if we significantly cut the number of police officers on the street in major urban areas or whatever, I don't necessarily think that those urban areas would devolve into violent chaos. In fact, I think that economically developed people would be able to invest and provide defense for their own persons and property relatively easily, especially in light of our functioning markets for those goods and services that we have today. However, despite that optimism about the lessons learned from shock therapy, I think that our current fiscal stimulus programs and quantitative easing does not give me optimism about that actually taking place. In other words, for all the talk and recognition about how much we stand to save by cutting things like the war on drugs out of our criminal justice budget, we've just added so much money to the budget that it's really going to take years before we can recognize how all of this new money is going to change the proportions, the sort of everything from the capital resource enforcement to the drugs versus property rights enforcement proportions, how those things will pan out in the years to come in light of these exponential gains in financing that we're doing across the board for governmental services. Only time will tell. I mean, unless you've got the time and the patience to be slogging through all the forms of stimulus bills that are coming down the pipeline day in and day out. This is just this again is from 2009, but over close to $3 billion of added resources into various forms, again, specifically earmarked in large part for drug enforcement. And we just like 2 days ago, there was a massive expansion in law enforcement involvement with Mexico, in large part tied to the drug trade. So while, again, I like Jeff Miron's report, it's fantastic, it's going to essentially have to be rewritten 5 years from now because the numbers are going to be washed in an exponential sea of increased financing, which could either is most likely to exaggerate the problems that we're already experiencing. We've got about a half an hour for questions and answers. And again, I would remind that today is the last lecture in our course series, so I'm open to fielding questions about anything and everything from the course of the summer. I would just like to say I've had a very enjoyable time preparing these lectures and participating in this sort of new technological venture. It's been a learning experience for me. I'm more used to having live audiences and getting instant feedback. I don't know whether people are laughing at jokes, and so without laughter as payment, I tend to tell fewer of them. But again, we're ready to field questions if any of the class members have any, and they would be willing to type them into the chat box. Thank you very much. It has been awesome to get this from you without going to Louisiana. Well, thanks, Lucas. Danny, I, and Jeff have been talking about another class, hopefully on sort of current events topics, elaborating more detail from my Freedom Watch experiences, as well as commenting on matters of libertarian ideology in pop culture and the economics of culture. How is the post-grad thing moving at Loyola? It is moving. However, basically what we did was we submitted a proposal which was had two major portions. One was a full sort of curriculum suggestion as to how we would be motivating a master's program, and the second was the resources that would be required to making that happen, which involves faculty as well as financial fundraising. Admittedly, as everyone is probably well aware, there are ideological obstacles in higher education. So it was difficult getting everything approved across faculty lines at this stage, but what we are hoping to move forward on is putting together a fundraising proposal to garner new faculty hires. So what we're trying to do, step one, is grow the department with more free market Austrian economists and grow the reputation of publishing and student placement from that, and then make the case stronger to our local administration that we have the resources ideally, in the future, we'll be able to say, we have the resources already in place, and so there's no uncertainty about garnering those resources or raising those resources, but instead just sort of approving curriculum to be enhanced. So the stage we're at right now is appealing to fundraising to hire new faculty. So step one will be getting fundraising for new faculty. Step two will be hiring new faculty. Step three will be continuing to research and support students in the Austrian tradition. And step four will then be approval and formal recognition of a master's program. So we are moving forward with developing a fundraising strategy to increase faculty hires. So that is how the post-grad thing is moving at Loyola. Awesome. Thanks. Have you read Resist Not Evil? And if so, I would be interested to know what your views on it were. I thumbed through that the day that Jeff put it up. I hadn't read it before or heard of it necessarily. I like the general thrust, though I'm not... Again, I'm not a natural rights theorist per se, my frustration with using that approach is that it's often unconvincing to more hard-nosed law and order types. I get a similar frustration with constitutional arguments. So, for example, a lot of the Cato Institute's publications are these very, like, really interesting titles and public policy issues. And then the books are usually set up like, okay, here's what the Constitution says about gun regulation or air pollution or medical insurance. Then here's our argument for why all of these things that have occurred in the last decade or so are unconstitutional. And then lots of that material also has really good economic analysis in it. And then a conclusion about sort of public policy reforms therefrom. But my frustration with the packaging in terms of constitutionality is that the response is usually just, nuh-uh, you read the Constitution differently than I do. When it, trying to make a case against incarceration per se or the state's role in criminal law from a natural rights or moral philosophical, morally philosophical perspective, I think runs the risk of merely being interpreted in the opposite fashion. I think that the Resist Not Evil text is also older, and so it's all the more interesting to read it in light of the fact that you can in different environments without the magnitude and jarring nature of, say, our criminal justice empirical reality, there are obviously writers and activists willing to condemn systems far less problematic than ours. And so it runs the risk of being sort of accused of sensationalism, but I like the thesis. I myself am like radical on these issues. I'm the more I think about it, the more I'm willing and interested in starting a formally identified like contemporary abolitionist movement against the practice of incarceration generally. I'm putting together a draft of a paper for a conference which is on the topic of human trafficking, and so I don't plan on doing any particular unique research on the topic of human trafficking, but instead trying to package the paper at the get-go from saying, well, incarceration is a form of human trafficking, and we should be really, really concerned about that. And so if anyone is guilty of human trafficking, it's governments around the world. So, yeah, Resist Not Evil, I mean, it's a good book. I think that a lot of people would find a lot of really powerful ideas in it, whether or not it's sort of useful in breaking down economic cause and effect relationships, or how much it opens your eyes to understanding the course of history surrounding criminal justice, I'm not sure of. More questions. Are you optimistic about a move to privatization in the criminal justice system in the near future, or do you believe that a serious crisis would have to ensue to force people to change their opinions? Well, I think what's going on in California is pretty interesting. I mean, in a very real sense, they're being forced to confront the fiscal instabilities of their criminal justice practices. They're being forced to release significant amounts of inmates. I think that that's a giant step in the right direction if you ask those inmates. And it doesn't necessarily seem to be sparking massive amounts of social discord as a consequence. Also, I think the Portugal example is really interesting. I was really disappointed with there was a recent conservatives versus libertarian debates amongst the Cato versus the Heritage Institute interns this summer, and it seemed so strange because the conservatives were arguing, we can't legalize drugs because of Portugal. And I want to say exactly the opposite. We should definitely legalize drugs because of Portugal. So they kept citing these notions that, oh, well, drug use went up amongst young people. Well, duh. They're going to be the people who have the lowest health risks associated with experimenting with various forms of drug use. And a number of empirical observations by, say, Levitt shows that the rises and falls of drug use, as we have evidence in survey reports from, say, high school students who report a willingness to use these substances, doesn't come from changes in the prohibition regime or sentencing. They come from real engagement and experience with those substances. So when crack first hits the scene, lots of people try it. 5 years down the line, people start realizing that that substance isn't really for me, and they don't do it nearly as much. Now, I think that, again, the majority of the social consequences that people point to, especially in relation to drugs, are problems associated with addiction more so than they are with those substances. And addiction transcends substances. The same sort of pattern of behaviors that are involved with overeating, are involved with overdrinking, are involved with over smoking, are involved with over heroin use. And the structure and patterns of behavior look similar. And typically, they are compensating behaviors for some underlying trauma or psychological issue. In other words, dealing with addiction is a matter of therapy and psychological counseling a lot more than it is a problem of keeping, like physiologically, keeping people away from substances. So insofar as I think that the Portugal case is giving us really, really tangible, a real tangible experience as to the potential for radical decriminalization, that gives me hope. I also think that significant portions of society are just insulating themselves from the harmful effects of criminal justice by means of privatization. And jokingly, I call myself a hydroponic libertarian insofar as I've been grown in-house for a very long time, it seems. I went to undergrad with Walter. I went to graduate school at George Mason. I've never really had to interact with mainstream intelligentsia. I've always had very friendly and supportive colleagues to work around. In much the same way, before I even went to undergrad, though, I grew up in South Florida in a private security neighborhood. And so when I first got exposed to the ideas of anarcho-capitalism in terms of police, courts, and prisons, I'd grown up sort of knowing full well what Wackenup Corporation was and what private security neighborhoods looked like and how public parks and public spaces could be provided by companies and for pay services as opposed to government taxes. And I think that if you spend time in those environments, there's a very visceral and tacit recognition of how criminal justice processes operate. I mean, just the filtering of you're not allowed to sort of just wander about in these neighborhoods without going through the guard gate, without having a purpose to be there, especially when it's a residential neighborhood. And in that sense, there is no significant need for constant patrolling over those neighborhood properties either. And so youths, for example, who are interested in either doing drugs or a variety of host of, say, what would otherwise be illegal behaviors, the attitude of enforcement is much more often take it outside or don't flaunt it, whereas the attitude in more governmentally provided space is a lot more forceful, compliant. I mean, just Google or YouTube, skateboarding is not a crime, or any number of violent police encounters to recognize how those things operate in comparative terms. So I'm very optimistic about as people, as our housing markets hopefully improve, that people will opt for quality in housing markets attuned to crime and safety issues. A lot of people find it difficult to understand why individuals subject themselves to the regulatory constraints of, say, private neighborhood associations, like what color you can paint your door, deed restrictions on your landscaping, et cetera. And they fail to recognize that the benefits of crime deterrence are so high with those areas relative to the insignificant cost of, say, losing some autonomy in what you can, like, what kind of car you can park in your driveway is a valuable trade-off. So I'm optimistic on that side. I'm pessimistic about the nature of our spending. I think that what the history of criminal justice services and the history of incarceration tells us is that the net amount of resources matters. I'm really, it's not so much the content of the book or necessarily what Tyler Cowen says in The Great Stagnation, but reading that book really got me to think a lot about this concept that he calls government by ox cart. And so Cowen argues that, well, the 19th century in the United States was a time of very vibrant economic prosperity and small government, and part of it was because of the brilliant sort of application of our federalist system and the checks and balances of our Constitution, et cetera. But another part of it was just sheer logistics. It's really difficult to be coercive, taxing, regulatory, excessively regulatory, and predatory upon your population when the only technology of that form of intervention is an ox cart, right? The reality of the situation was there was no transportation system to distribute people. There was no internet. There was no telecommunication system. That there wasn't a standardized system of tax administration, of centrally withholding taxes, of voter registration. None of those things were in place. Well, fast forward the clock a bit, and you're naturally going to get a state that does a lot more things when it has a lot more of those technologies in its disposal. And in that sense, I think that there is something very, very disconcerting about not only the expansion of, say, financial resources into the criminals, into law enforcement, but the expansion of those financial resources in law enforcement without any serious attention paid to processes of, say, constitutional constraint and checks and balances as to how to adjust for those new net volumes. James Buchanan has this great insight: if you tripled the size of a fly, it wouldn't be able to get off the ground. A night watchman state can, like, do only so much harm, but a night watchman state that has Kevlar vests, SWAT team riot gear, and or a tank in a town the size of like 20,000 people, it's pretty unreasonable to expect that limited state to remain so limited with so much physical power at its disposal. And I think that one thing that gets sort of lost in a lot of the libertarian activism and civil disobedience and YouTube momentum that's going on lately against police brutality and stuff like that. I think that it's one thing to point out abuses of police authority and sort of corruption, and that's sort of shameful and whatnot. But I think what's all the more interesting is the portion of these behaviors and social problems that are endemic in the system of incentives and knowledge generated in the institutional provision of centrally controlled, administered, and monopolized law enforcement. In other words, in crude terms, for lack of a better explanation, you've got like middle-aged not-so-educated guys who run police jurisdictions throughout the country. Well, for a long period of time, they did a degree of harm in their local environments, but only so much because, well, they were things like local sheriffs and police chiefs, and they had certain scope of power, and they could deploy a certain amount of troops, and so on and so forth. Well, now we've basically increased their budgets and equipment 10, 20-fold in some areas. So we have the same sort of bumbling inept local cops, but empowered with this greater significant military force behind them. The forms of those problems are likely to be a lot more costly in terms of civil liberties as well as in terms of deterrent effects. And when our criminal justice system is aligned towards deterring things that otherwise should be taking place, we're really impoverishing ourselves. One of the things that came out recently was the notion that the government is now regulating and mandating that all internet service providers record all of your internet activities for up to a year and keep them on server so that the government can search them at the point that they want. Well, two things I think are going to result from this. One is that people are going to use the internet for things that they are concerned about being of secretive nature less frequently. Which is to say that we're sort of impoverishing ourselves from the amount and ability that we use the internet. And secondly, they're going to invest in strategies to maintain that secrecy even amidst the internet. But even that is a form of spurious discovery. So in both instances, we're wasting resources evading state inefficiency. We've got about time for two more questions. Just a brief reminder, the quiz for this lecture as well as the last lecture should be up within the next week. I apologize for the delay on that. But I'm pretty sure that there has been no formal deadlines on when students were required to take those. So even though we're at the end, you can take all of the quizzes now. Or once these last two quizzes are up, you can take all of them and still get graded credit. They're pretty straightforward multiple choice quizzes that just cover a hodgepodge of the material from each lecture. I'm not sure which of you is taking the class for credits or just for consumptive fun, but for either case, feel free to look at the quizzes, take them yourselves or keep them on hand for your own purposes. Not hearing many more questions. Okay, here we go. What do you think of the insurance-based justice system as presented by Bob Murphy's chaos theory? I like the thought of it. I think what it alludes to is, so for those who don't know, Bob basically describes how bundling services like insurance could require certain behavioral constraints on people who pose risks to other people. Like if you were needing to subscribe to some sort of law enforcement agency, then they would likely charge you a higher premium if you had criminal histories and or insist that you comply with a variety of behavioral conditions. We see this, the same sort of practices are used in probation today by the state. I think that attempts to explain from sort of beginning to end a functional system of privatized criminal justice is problematic because by definition what we would need is trial and error. A lot more likely would be things like institutional arrangements that you read about when you read work like Eleanor Ostrom. She talks about water administration and notices, like, well, here's this diversity of how different local townships found ways to govern and control and avoid tragedies of the commons in these environments. So I think that what Bob is getting at the heart of in chaos theory is that, look, there's a lot of different ways that we could avoid and deter crime without the explicit coercive and violent nature of the state that would lend itself towards more contractarian solutions, more voluntary solutions, and align interests of those service providers to find the things that work the best, which I think is the best part of what Bob describes there. Mainly that if you have individuals who have a productive capacity, you want to figure out what that is and incentivize it the most. A similar conversation I got into on the blogosphere, and you guys can look this up a bit, Brian Kaplan read and gave me feedback on a paper, the sort of core chapter of his dissertation about disproportionality in sentencing in the criminal justice system. And Brian had a hard time wrestling with the idea that the system itself is overly punitive. And so his argument was like, yes, it's overly punitive when it comes to enforcing against drug laws, but it might even be underly punitive when it comes to enforcing violent crime. And in other words, he said, okay, let's look at what sort of restitution amounts we could think of, like in realistic terms, for a certain type of offense. Like, let's say someone mugs you and breaks your arm. Well, a broken arm in hospital bills costs a significant amount of money. You might lose work. Let's say you would want some sort of punitive damages to assure that this guy wasn't going to go and break your arm again, so on and so forth. Add to that the average earnings of the average inmate outside, and then consider how much it would take them to pay it off and interest rates. If you come up with criminal sanctions to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars, if somebody mugs you and breaks your arm, they're probably only going to jail for a couple of years, and their ability to actually produce hundreds of thousands of dollars in that environment would be unlikely. But I think that that's a very sort of static vision of that array, of that menu of prices that Brian relies upon. And so I put up a blog post in response that surveyed a variety of what I call market-based management strategies or market-based prison management strategies that have been used and I've found in sort of researching over the years. Everything from wood-making shops to designer jean labels to rodeos, et cetera. Many wardens have either allowed for inmates themselves or coordinated on their own part to turn their prison facilities into productive capitalist endeavors, so to speak, with significant results. So I don't think it's right to just presume that the marginal product of labor from criminal populations is automatically low. And so I think that Bob gets that in a way that Brian doesn't. So I like that aspect of Bob's work. But I don't... I don't necessarily think that insurance premiums are the have-all, be-all of anarcho-capitalist law enforcement. I think when you look at a variety of stateless environments, a lot of what does the heavy lifting more so than formal contractarian insurance programs is instead very informal cultural practices that also tie in forms of insurance. So things like civil society organizations and cultural manifestations. Admittedly, it sounds really weird, but urban practices of freestyle rap battling, basically have been argued in anthropological literature is a form of tension release when conflicts have the potential of going violent amongst competing gangs or competing factions of individuals, etc. These practices look remarkably similar to everything from the Attic orators in ancient Greece to Eskimo conflict resolution practices that you can see in a variety of sort of like tribal and primitive examples, that people invest in culture as a clear and present signal of nonviolence. That at the very least, it might not be incredibly functional, it might not be completely economically optimal, but it is functional insofar as it avoids conflict. And the question is how that can be sustained in larger scale environments. Now, maybe the formal codifications of insurance contracts could do that, and it would be great if they could. We are about out of time. I'm glad that a lot of you guys continuously say that you have enjoyed the course. I am also blogging at a site now called The Imprisoner's Dilemma, which is everything from current commentary on current events to, the general theme is going to obviously be criminal justice and punishment topics. So feel free to comment there and or follow. Email me if you have any questions, and I really appreciate everybody showing up for the class.